against it if we read only modern books. Where they are true, they will give us truths which we have knew already. Where they are false, they will aggravate the error with which we are already dangerously ill. The only palliative, great choice of words there, the only palliative is to keep the clean sea breeze of the centuries blowing through our minds. Isn't that a great sentence? You gotta hate Lewis in a lot of ways. I mean, he's so good. I'll read that again. The only palliative is to keep the clean sea breeze of the centuries blowing through our minds, and this can be done only by reading old books. Two heads are better than one, not because either is infallible, but because they are unlikely to go wrong in the same direction. To be sure, the books of the future would be just as good a corrective as the books of the past, but unfortunately, we cannot get at them. Isn't that lovely?
Yes.
And I operate, you know, I teach church history, and I operate by that all the time, as I'll explain in just a minute. So let me tell you just a little bit about my calling and the relevance for this particular workshop. I serve as a professor of church history at a Christian university, and I was a pastor first for 10 years. And that got in my blood, and it's really affected my teaching. I kind of teach half as a pastor as well as a church historian. I've never been able to quite shake that influence on my life, and so I define myself as a theologian for the church and as a bridge between academy and church and academy. I classify myself as grounded in the great tradition of historic orthodoxy. We actually use that phrase, great tradition, a lot at Whitworth University. In the Pacific Northwest, you know, we're such a highly secular part of the country. Rates of church attendance are just abysmally low, much lower than, say, in the Midwest and in the South. I think in Spokane, the average church attendance on a Sunday is 8% of the population. That would not be true in the Midwest and in the South. And so we're getting used to what it means to be post-Christendom in spades and what it means to do evangelism and discipleship in that kind of environment. So great tradition is what sort of unites. I've done two retreats in the last year for Catholic groups. Wow, think about that. I'm a self-identified Reformed evangelical, Catholics. And these are real Catholics. And I did a conference at a church just a few weeks ago for a Catholic church in town. A lot of people were there. And you have this sense that simply it's different now. It's not the same anymore as it was even 20, 25 years ago. Some of you are old enough to remember what it was like to be a Protestant or Catholic in the 50s and 60s. I don't have much of a remembrance of being a little bit, though, when Kennedy was running for office, and everyone was nervous that we were going to be putting the Pope in the White House. So a group of Protestant ministers met with him in Houston, Texas in 1960 to interview him to find out how far his Catholicism would go as in his service in the presidency. And he promised them that when he walked in the door of the White House, he would leave his Catholicism behind. What a tragedy. I want somebody like the Pope in the White House, frankly. That's another issue altogether. So in Northwest, this sense of belonging to the great tradition of the historic Orthodox faith, with perhaps expressions or leanings toward Reformed or Evangelical or Catholic or Orthodox, is starting to make more and more sense all the time. It's a robust ecumenism, not a watered-down ecumenism, I think the kind that ought to be. Well, anyway, when I teach my church history courses, I don't just teach them as a stuff about a bunch of people, names, dates, and theology. I really try to present to students that these were actual real people. And they lived real lives. So that dictates how I teach. We sing every day in class. Every day, for a whole year, because I want to introduce them to the history of how the church has sung, because you do sing the faith, right? So we're going to start the Reformation next week, Wednesday, and we're going to start right off by singing the late medieval hymn, And then we'll sing some of the great Lutheran hymnody that was written by people like Philip, well, a generation later, Philip Nicolai, and so on. I mean, just rich stuff. And then we'll bring it all the way through into the 20th century. So music is a part of our heritage, isn't it? And church history courses forget about that, that we've been singing the faith for a long time. So we sing, we read a lot of primary texts. In the first half of the course, or in the first semester, we use the Divine Office every day. So they can get a feel for the rhythms of the Divine Office and Benedictine monasticism. See what I mean? I use a lot of slides, a lot of visuals, anything that draws them into the life of the church and its history instead of merely what Christians thought at one time. Because, you know, Christians, we've evangelized, we've traveled, we've planted churches, we've fought, we've split, we've killed, we've made up, we've divided, we've united, we've done a lot of things, and I want my students to gain a sense of that along the way. I also use a wide variety of genres, so they'll read a collection of letters. By the way, one of the best windows into the Reformation period is Luther's Pastoral Correspondence. Is anyone familiar with that, written by a Tapper? It was edited by Tapper, T-A-P-P-E-R-T. It's fabulous. It's just Luther's letters written under as a pastor to people. There's a chapter on marriage, and some hilarious ones, by the way. He could be a little off-colored sometimes. And I have my students read the correspondence among the three Cappadocian fathers. Now, there's the theology there everywhere. They're complaining about the Arians and forming their arguments with each other and how about trying this and that. But then they're complaining about the weather. They're having fights with each other. They talk about the slow and bad postal system. That creates that texture and color that you want when you're studying church history, and I hope we can do the same when it comes to the way we worship too, which is why we're here today. All right, I want to begin by making an argument for you. It's going to take about maybe 8 to 10 minutes is all. I'm going to create an argument, and then at the end of that, we'll talk about historical sources, and I'll get you to work in some way. So here's how I'm going to craft this argument about worship and the use of history along the way. Okay, step one. The goal of worship is to orient our lives around the most fundamental truth in all of reality. God is God, we're not. So all of worship is a kind of reorientation. A reorientation of our lives, a calling back to what is most central about reality. God is God. We know who that God is in Jesus Christ and through the Holy Spirit. And we're not God. And we're never going to be. So it rearranges. So creator, creature. We get that straight. And, you know, we do that in a lot of ways. We do it, if you just look at our order of worship, we do it through praise. That's acknowledging that God is the center of all of reality. Confession, we admit that we spend too much time trying to play God with disastrous consequences. Pardon, we receive and revel in God's mercy and forgiveness. Some kind of dedication to renew our commitment to live for God and not for ourselves. An offering, we offer ourselves as stewards to God. Not just our money, it's offering of self to God. Silence, prayer, instruction, various postures. My son goes to a PCUSA, really great PCUSA church in Durham, North Carolina, a Black Knoll it's called. They kneel every worship. I love that. I love using our bodies more. We Dutch Calvinists are so stiff. And there's a lot to learn there. So even the way we use our bodies and, of course, the sacraments and so on. Okay, so that's step one. It's a reorientation of our lives. Step two. All formal worship follows an order and reflects a certain style. It follows an order and it reflects a certain style. In other words, it's based on a set of practices. In that sense, all churches are liturgical, even the ones that claim they're not. All churches are liturgical. They follow an order. They're based on a set of practices. And all churches do those for a reason. They do them for, I don't care whether you're the highest Anglican Catholic or whether you're the absolute lowest church four square. Every way that a church worships, they do it for a reason. But it's easy to forget why. That gets lost. So what was at one time new and fresh made a lot of sense to a church, using contemporary worship or using a hymn book for the first time or following a very complex, dense liturgy. That was new and fresh, and people all understood it. Over time, we begin to forget, don't we? We just kind of do it without as much thoughtfulness. We stop asking, why are we worshiping this way? What's the purpose to it? What's the reason behind it? And so on. All right, step three. Worship, therefore, becomes habit over time. This is true for all congregations. There's no exceptions to this. And it's true for all pastors, too. And you know, it's not a bad thing. Nothing wrong with habits. Habits, we all have them, and they can be good habits. As in many endeavors, we like to develop and follow routines. So, for example, my guess is if you live in a family, you'll probably tend to sit at the same seat at the table every meal. There are some exceptions. Most families do that. Or in a classroom. By the second week of class, my students are all sitting in the same seat, and they keep going back. And when I shake things up, they feel really disoriented. I mean, you sense that they're almost been violated somehow. Don't make me sit in the front or in the back, you know, that kind of thing. You ever notice that you shop at a grocery store the same way? You know, I was a single parent for many years, widow. And I tell you, I had a routine when I got into that grocery store, exactly followed it the same way every time. See, these are habits. We form all kinds of habits when it comes to our lives, and the same is true in worship. We develop worship habits because we like the familiar and comfortable. It provides a sense of order and security. Habit means we don't have to make as many decisions. That relaxes us. Over time, however, these habits turn into compulsions. It's a word that Augustine uses in the Confessions. Compulsions. We must worship that way. And we start to feel really disoriented when we're not worshiping that way. We hardly know there are other alternatives, and if they're out there and we know of them, we feel uncomfortable using them. And this is when we start to think about worship as filling in slots. In the old days, 50s, 60s, and 70s are more traditional services. It would be pick three hymns. Here's the theme of the sermon. Or four worship songs before we do the offering. And make the last one a little bit more subdued. And I'm not saying this cynical. We just do this. If you have a high church kind of liturgy, you just kind of do the same thing. Wow, that's kind of magic. That, too, becomes compulsion. You'll notice churches do announcements the same way. Pastor or associate pastor. Well, there's a lot going on this week at the church. You can check the bulletin. I want to highlight these three things. And they do it at the same time. Could be at the beginning of service. Usually it's someplace in the middle, which seems really horrible to me, but we do it. I mean, you're kind of breaking worship with announcements. I mean, it's sort of like a advertisement during a TV show. Let's run to the refrigerator and get a sandwich or something. We should dismiss people to go to the bathroom during announcements. So, okay. Over time, therefore, we lose our ability, now listen to this carefully, to inhabit our habits. To inhabit our habits. So that we're truly worshiping God. We forget the why, the what, and the how. worship becomes formal and routine, but then listen to this, form turns to formalism. And when we tend to formalism, we tend to think of Catholic and Anglican or Lutheran right away. Anything can be formalism. Lowest church four-square service can be just as formal as a high church Anglican. Doesn't matter. Form turns to formalism, routine to rote, tradition to traditionalism. I'm quoting, I'm sure many of you have heard of this wonderful quote from Yaroslav Halevin. Tradition is the living faith of the dead. Traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. Isn't that a great quote? Then a crisis occurs. You've all witnessed it, experienced it, or heard about it. In most cases, some kind of change in circumstances. Oh, let's say a new form of popular music that begins to make its way into the life of the church. A shift in demographics. Growing secularity. A change of pastor. Anything. Something happens in the life of a congregation that forces makes easy adherence to a particular form of worship more difficult or impossible. In other words, there's a shakeup. And increasingly unsatisfying. You start to hear complaints, rumblings. Could be a small group of people that has gone to a conference and they come back. Oh yeah, well here we are. Didn't even intend that. They go to a conference or they go through a renewal of some kind. They discover something new in their small group, or they go on a retreat, or you cross some age threshold, or you start to lose a lot of people in their teens and 20s. Something happens that shakes things up and creates division, questions, uneasiness, maybe some controversy along the way, and somehow it always finds its way to worship, how you worship. The habit begins to lose its power and cogency for a vocal minority. At this point, some people remain fiercely loyal and defensive. Others oppose and leave, relocating in a church that seems more compatible with their changing tastes and interests. This is how megachurches experience a lot of their growth. Not entirely. They can win converts too. But they always attract some disaffected people from churches that aren't changing. So there's a new church plant, they go there. A megachurch. Maybe a church that's using an Anglican liturgy. I'm so bored with the worship music, you know, whatever it happens to be. And still others, unfortunately, drop out altogether. Rates of church dropout among teens, late teens and 20s, is, as you all know by now, precipitously high. It varies depending on the part of the country in which you're living, but it is precipitously high. Now, end of argument. I cannot solve this problem. We cannot solve this problem completely. This is just going to happen as a matter of course. But a partial solution, it seems to me, is to get ahead of it by intentionally expanding a congregation's capacity for worship. Expanding their capacity for worship. Exposing the congregation to new forms of worship without rejecting the old. Exposing the congregation to new forms of worship without rejecting the old, and enlarging the repertoire of a congregation's worship resources. Enlarging their repertoire very slowly. And to do it thoughtfully, or what I would call catechetically. In worship, we reflect on what we are doing so that we learn how to worship as we are worshiping. We learn how to worship as we are worshiping. Now, I want to add one other note. It may be less true in Grand Rapids than it is on the West Coast, but I want to add that one other factor that's becoming increasingly apparent in certain parts of the country, and that is people simply know less Bible. They know less about the Christian story. than they did a generation or two ago. They don't know theology, they don't know hymnody, they don't know history, they don't know the literature. They're really becoming outsiders of the faith. Maybe in the Midwest, parts of the Midwest, smaller towns and in the South, you're going to have people who have drifted, but they've still got a lot of stuff inside them. I can't tell you the number of people I meet on the West Coast. I live in Spokane. I've got a bunch of kids living in Seattle. They're clueless. They know nothing. It's pretty amazing. My son, John, my youngest, married an adult convert. She came to know Christ at 20. She came from a zero background. She knew nothing. She had been to a church twice her entire life, two weddings. I mean, it was like starting from scratch, and it's kind of fun, actually. She married the right guy, my son John. He's sweet and patient and really grounded, but her questions, she doesn't have any of the lingo, none of the habits. She is an unenculturated Christian. And she married into my family. I'm just saturated with Christianity, and my wife is too, and my kids are. And my middle son went to seminary. I mean, it's a kind of a comedy in a way, but it's a sweet one. So that's kind of what we're seeing more and more of. Now think about how we worship in light of my daughter, who's not been enculturated, doesn't know anything. The lingo, the habits, even the language you use of our common speech as Christians. I'm going to have time with the Lord. A quiet time. I mean, she's had to learn everything because she knew nothing along the way. So when people bring very little levels of knowledge and experience to worship, it really forces us to make a decision. On the one hand, we could simply keep accommodating to them, in which case our worship gets thinner all the time. That's what mega churches, seeker-friendly churches, have leaned toward. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not making a value judgment. What they wanted to do is become accessible to outsiders. They lean in that direction by using forms and styles and sounds and everything that are going to be attractive and accessible and understandable to those people. The danger is that it gets so thin, there's not enough grab, stick, traction. The other extreme is we just won't adapt at all, in which case we become irrelevant. It seems to me a better solution is to figure out how to be more thoughtful about what we do in worship. Not only for the outsider who's coming in, but for the people in our congregation who are no longer inhabiting their habits, no longer know why we're actually doing what we're doing. And I would suggest we can do this in very thoughtful, understated ways without being ponderous, heavy, boring, insufferable in the process, where we're turning worship into about 10 mini-sermons. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a thoughtful expansion of one's capacity and the repertoire that we use in worship itself, so that our language, we Christians have a language, don't we? It's not just a biblical language, it's a theological language. It's a Trinitarian language. We're neglecting the Trinity big time. I mean, modern worship songs is non-Trinitarian music in a lot of ways. So that would be one example. We have a language, we have a liturgy, we have creeds, we have practices. We even have sacred objects. In the case of Christians, it would be the chalice, it would be the cup. It'd be the baptismal font, the table, and other things of that kind. Thoughtful. I want us to be thoughtful as we expand the church's repertoire and expand their capacity to use resources to worship God meaningfully, which is what we're going to do. Okay, so now that this is the workshop we're doing. First of all, I would like you to take about 5 minutes, and I want you to take your church and its worship, just its worship, and try to look at it from the moment you walk into the door of wherever it is you worship and what you would see and experience if you had never been in church before. In other words, if you were my daughter-in-law when she was 20 years old, what would you see and experience? What would make sense and not make sense? So in other words, just look at your worship habits. Everything. How are people dressed? What do they see? In my case, I go to a downtown First Presbyterian church, a wonderful church. You walk in the door, pews. Huge organ in the front. Now, an organ is a really alien instrument, isn't it? In our culture. I love organ music. I listen to Bach organ preludes and fugues and stuff all the time. I'm a freak of nature for doing that. So what do they see? What do they experience when they're going through a worship service? I want you to start with that so you're thoughtful about what you do. Now, I'm not doing this to criticize. That's not my point. I hope you don't hear that. I'm not going after the way you worship. I don't really care how you worship. Do it the way you want to. I want you to do it more thoughtfully and expansively. All right, so I want you to start there. I'm hoping you all have something to write with. Just put on a new set of eyes. You know nothing. You've never been to a church before. What do you see and experience when you walk into that building and go through an hour of worship? Okay? Start with that. I'll give you only about 5 minutes, not much, but just get the juices flowing, if nothing else. okay, I'm assuming juices are going. Talk to somebody for 30 seconds about one thing you observed that was interesting. Again, I'm not suggesting, oh my gosh, we're way too religious here. Remember, we all have liturgies, we all follow habits. It doesn't really matter what it is. I'm not suggesting you got to tear down all the religious stuff in your church, break out the stained glass windows. I'm not a Calvinist and Puritan here in that sense. Okay? I'm not suggesting we go thin. I'm suggesting we're thoughtfully thick. All right? So just talk about one thing you observed. Maybe you hadn't even thought about for a while. One thing. It's an exercise. You can do a lot of things. Try to look at some part of your life, in this case, your practices, from an outside perspective. You could do it with your family dinners and other things. So you're starting to think more thoughtfully about what you actually do. It might just reinforce what you're doing. That's a good thing. It might suggest that you're going to add some things to what you're doing so that your life is a little richer and your capacities grow along the way. So this was intended just for worship. So the first thing is to think about what you're doing and how it would be viewed from an outside perspective. Because you don't want a club, do you? You don't want a church that is not accessible to people. But you might not want to give up all of your great tradition and liturgy to do that. Well, then you've got to come up with another solution, which is the second thing I want to say now by way of application. We have to learn to be more thoughtful about what we do. And what I would suggest is that in worship we develop almost unnoticeable little points of transition so that we are connecting what we're doing to the worshiper. Now let me give you an example. We're going to do a bunch of this, but I'm going to give you one example that's current. Last Sunday, I go to the contemporary service at our church with my wife, and we, on occasion, will sing a hymn, Newly Arranged. And this was Just As I Am. All right, now, who here knows anything about this hymn, Just As I Am? I know some of the folks that are a little bit older here are going to know exactly why this is such a powerful hymn. Why?
Billy Graham.
Okay. All right, now, a 20-second introduction would have changed everything about that hymn. We just sang. But how about this? The song we're going to sing now is probably the most famous song on planet Earth. And you don't even know why, or most of you. This song has been used during a period when more people in all of human history have become Christians. It's been used at Billy Graham crusades or revival services since early 1950s. Hundreds, tens of millions of people have become Christian while this song was being sung. Now you sing it. Wow! Everything changes in that moment, it seems to me. Now, if you do it for 5 minutes, you're going to lose everybody. But you can do that in 20 seconds. That's being thoughtful. That's creating a bridge, a little point of transition that's drawing the people into what you're doing. Both with things that are unfamiliar, because 80% of the people would not have known that at our church, as well as the things that are familiar. Then it brings freshness, a confession, a pardon. We'll practice this in a minute, a season of the year. So here's another example of this little transition piece. My son and daughter-in-law, my youngest son and daughter-in-law, go to Quest. It's a great little Evangelical Covenant Church in Seattle. It's multicultural and interracial, so it's just a lively, vibrant place. I mean, it's got a lot of life. Very hip. A lot of 20-somethings there, including my son who's hauled like 20 of his friends there in the last year. So, Advent. The pastor introduced Advent. And he assumed nobody knew what he was talking about. He didn't do it for 5 minutes. He did it for about a minute. This is an ancient practice the church has done for a long time. We haven't done it here, and I want us to start. And then he gave a very brief, very tasteful, clear introduction to Advent. 80% of the people had never heard of it before at that church. What a great idea. Thoughtfulness. Every once in a while, Now, you don't do it 20 times. You do it maybe two or three. But it has a cumulative effect over a long haul with both old and new. Just as I am, Billy Graham's song. See, that kind of thing is what I'm talking about. So you assume nothing. It's educational for some people. It's refreshment for other people. But it draws them into the thoughtfulness of worship along the way. Okay, third, resources. Now what I'd like you to do here is think about categories of resources you can use, and I'm going to give a handout now that doesn't give you a list, but gives you examples within those categories. That's my goal, is all. I'll suggest a couple of books at the end that might be useful. Just fan them back that way. And somebody just collect all the extras over there because it's for tomorrow, too. What I mean by resources are little things that you draw from history, little sources from history, that can, again, have this kind of enlarging effect on your worship life. For example, hymns. All right, now here's the danger. Some of you, how many of you come from worship where you use a hymn book? Okay, well, figures you'd be at a conference like this, probably two-thirds of you, okay? So you're going to be more familiar with this literature. Newcomers to your church are not. That's a foreign language to them now. In the 50s and 60s and 70s, that wasn't so true. It is today. In the Northwest, I hardly know of a church. I know some small mainline churches that are using hymn books, but an increasing number of churches, they don't even have hymn books. What do they use? Screens. So I asked my students in my church history class, I've been asking this now for probably 20 years. How many of you were baptized as infants? All right? The number has dropped over the years. Now it's a clear minority. It used to be a majority. So they're being dedicated more than they're being baptized. The other thing is when we sing hymns through the year, I ask the students if they're familiar with the hymn. And it's dropped over 20 years significantly. Once you move beyond, you know, the Fab Five, Feed on My Vision, Amazing Grace, How Firm a Foundation, or Not Firm a Foundation, what's the one by? In Christ Alone, that's a modern hymn. Anyway, they're utterly clueless. So I'm wondering, even if you are familiar, if you can enlarge the repertoire of what they're singing in a way that's meaningful. I took a hymnology course from Eric Rowley, the great hymn master for a whole generation, at Westminster Choir College when I was younger, before he died. And he said in his research, he's come to the conclusion that the average church is really comfortable singing about 25 pieces of music. 25. And I think we could be thoughtful about enlarging that just a little bit, but we have to do it well. Here's the typical way of doing it. You just sing it, and nobody knows what they're doing. If you're singing contemporary music, the worship band will play through it once, and then people start to sing it, and they stumble like crazy. Instead of actually teaching them how to sing, all right? Which is what we're going to do in just a minute. I'll show you that. So music is one, prayers of the life of the church is another. In my church history class, we say at least one prayer every day from the history of the church. And I've got an example I'll show you there. A biblical text, how about introducing the text rather than just reading it? 20 seconds, something like this. One of the great leaders in the history of Christianity was a man by the name of the Apostle Paul. And he's left us letters that the church has gathered, preserved, and passed on. In one particular case, he wrote two letters to a church that was a wreck, a train wreck of a church. And he was trying to figure out how to solve their problems. Now, this particular passage is from... You know what you do? What you're doing is you're just setting up a little bit so that instead of saying, let's turn to 1 Corinthians 1 or 1 Corinthians 5, your insiders are going to know this. But an increasing number of people are not going to know it, and don't even assume that your insiders know it as well as they do. So everything happens with a little bit of a setup that's thoughtful and clear and winsome. So biblical texts, prayers of the church, church year and its various seasons, a story from history, a text from history, and so on and so forth. Okay? You got that. So you're going to do it in a second in practice, but I want us to come up with a couple of examples. So let's start with the hymn, okay? Of the Father's love begotten. I'm not going to assume anybody knows, but I bet half do. How many know this hymn comfortably? Okay, that's because you're all here, you're worshiping, so done. My students don't know this hymn, and many of your people don't know this hymn. Now, does anybody know anything about Prudentius? He was the Dante of early Christianity. He was a monk, worked in Rome for a while under the Pope. He's Latin-speaking, obviously, Prudentius. And he eventually retired to a monastery in Spain because he wanted to write poetry. If you Google him, does anybody have a computer on him? All right, Google Prudentius. You'll come up with tons of stuff. This particular hymn is actually drawn from a very, very long poem. And it's only three stanzas within that larger poem. So here's this unbelievably great poet. I actually have my students read some of his poetry, and we've lost him to historical memory. How sad that is. The other interesting little tidbit is that this particular hymn of the Father's love begotten, now you wouldn't be able to do this in church. This is too long. This is for you. But number one, it's using a form of music called plain song. You're all familiar with that. That's what we used to call Gregorian chant. You'll notice it has no time marking, 3-4, 4-4, anything like that, no bars. It's supposed to be sung much more stylistically. And the other thing that's interesting, women, a Prudentius, plain song, and one more thing to say. I'm sure I can't remember. Oh, yeah, the translator. I'm sure at least some of you have heard of a man by the name of John Mason Neal. Familiar. I want to know how many are familiar with him. All right, five of you. Probably we owe more to him than almost anybody in the history of Christianity. You know why? Because he translated Greek and Latin hymns to English. He was part of the Oxford movement of the 19th century. John Henry Cardinal Newman was a part of that group. He actually converted to Catholicism. These were Anglo-Catholics who wanted to discover the richness of the heritage of their own faith. And so they went back and rediscovered all these great Latin and Greek texts and translated them. So we're singing the work of John Mason Neal. Wow, is that cool? I obviously couldn't do that in a congregation. So this is how I teach my students to sing a hymn. And I do this in other places too, even when I'm doing a retreat sometimes. I'll sing it through once, and then I'll line it out, and they'll repeat. And then we'll do it together. So three times run through just with the first stanza, and it builds confidence. And you can tell when it builds confidence because the volume begins to go up and people begin to lean forward. And you sense they're starting to own it. So, of the Father's love begotten, ere the worlds began to be, he is Alpha and Omega, he the source, the ending be. Of the things that are, that have been, and that future year shall see, evermore and evermore. It's lovely. It is so lovely. And the other thing you'll notice about early Christian hymnody, it's all Trinitarian. All right, now, I'm going to line it out. Even if you know it, we're going to do this in practice. I'm going to line it out. You repeat after me. Okay, so I'll do a line. You repeat. Of the Father's love begotten.
Of the Father's love begotten.
Ere the world began to be.
Ere the world began to be. the ending he.
Of the things that are that have been,
of the things that are that have been,
and that future year shall see,
and that future year shall see,
evermore and evermore,
evermore.
Into this project. Honestly, they fall in love with this stuff. But one of the reasons why they do is they get confidence that they can sing. So anyway, that's one example. Now you can do it your own way. Maybe it's not relevant to you. I'm just saying that there's so much wealth here. In the early Christian medieval, some are singable, some are not, but I think it's a meaningful addition. Okay, another one of prayers. Okay, so Anselm of Canterbury died in 1109. And Anselm was the Archbishop of Canterbury. And during his lifetime, an army had crossed the English Channel and it invaded England. It was in 1066. Who were they?
Normans.
The Normans, French-speaking. That's why... especially in the eastern part of England, there are so many French town names. And the names of French monasteries, like Rivaux, outside of York, it's because French was the court language for a long time in England. So Anselm is an appointed person, obviously, occupying the bishop's chair, archbishop's chair, from Rome, and he's functioning as an archbishop in a very troubled time. He's got enemies. Now, listen to this prayer. Almighty and tender Lord Jesus Christ, just as I have asked you to love my friends, so I ask the same for my enemies. You alone, Lord, are mighty. You alone are merciful. Whatever you make me desire for my enemies, give it to them and give the same back to me. If I ever ask for them anything which is outside your perfect rule of love, whether through weakness, ignorance, or malice, good Lord, do not give it to them and do not give it back to me. You who are the true light, lighten their darkness. You who are the whole truth, correct their errors. You who are the incarnate word, give life to their souls. Tender Lord Jesus, let me not be a stumbling block to them, nor a rock of offense. My sin is sufficient to me without harming others. I, slave to sin, beg your mercy on my fellow slaves. Let them be reconciled with you and through you reconciled to me. Imagine saying that prayer after 9/11. Wow. We have so much stuff like this at our fingertips. Now, overuse it, poor people, they're going to start feeling very little, slow and steady over a long period of time. Okay, I'm going to have you do something with the Teresa prayer, so we're going to hold on to that. Now, some texts. This is a little trickier. You can't do this every week, but maybe you could have a great text, a great quote that you would introduce maybe once a month or once every 2 months that would, again, enrich them, expose them to the larger voice and thinking of the church. I won't read this, but one of my favorites is from the so-called Letter to Diognetus. Oh my gosh, is this a good quote. I'll just draw one example. Halfway down, he's explaining to a Roman official how Christians lived in the second century. They live in their own countries, but only as aliens. They have a share in everything as citizens and endure everything as foreigners. Every foreign land is their fatherland, and yet for them, every fatherland is a foreign land. We're all resident aliens. I'm not an American citizen. I'm a member of the kingdom of God. I have more in common with my Korean brothers and sisters in South Korea than I do with my next-door neighbor. So what a text to use on the red occasion. Unbelievable. The next one is from Sang from the Desert Fathers, one of my areas of specialty. I love these guys. This is a hilarious story that we don't have time to read. And then Hippolytus. Now, here's what I'd like you to do for the next couple of minutes. I want you to pick a text from Scripture. Anything. I have the 1 Corinthians 3 down there. You can use that one, Philippians, maybe a gospel story. Just think of one quickly. Figure out how you can give a 20-second introduction to that text that would be meaningful for our congregation. 20 seconds. That's assignment one. If we don't really have time, but it would be fun for you to introduce the Teresa prayer. Teresa of Avila, have you ever heard of her? 16th century kind of mystic, founder of the Discalced Carmelites. It is a fabulous prayer. So many resources like this available that are at our fingertips. And I'll give you a couple of suggestions. But start with a biblical passage, 20-second introduction that you're going to practice on somebody else. Go. Got a pen, jot something down, I'd like you to. Try to say something to a neighbor now that will introduce a biblical text in a way that will be thoughtful, building a bridge between the text and the congregation, setting them up to be drawn into it. Try it. 20 seconds. Go. With your neighbor. You're all busy people. And we think that busyness is an invention of the modern world. So, pray this prayer with me. How is it, my God, that you have given me this hectic, busy life when I have so little time to enjoy your presence? Throughout the day, people are waiting to speak with me, and even at meals, I have to continue talking to people about their needs and problems. During sleep...